accession number 19387, Reel 5.
Tony Perrins, Reel 5.
The time frames, of course, for all this, I assumed that we were with Bob matter 2-3 days. Could well have been longer, could have been less, I don't know. But Bob was removed from us. Chinese, for reasons unknown, were singularly, they didn't like our doctors looking after us, which sounds absurd. I would have thought it would have been for everybody's benefit, including the Chinese, to allow them to work, but Bob vanished. We were put back onto ox carts and taken on to another village where I met Beverly Gale for the first time. Beverly Gale was a second lieutenant in the Gloucesters who had national service, got his national service commission, was put on a troop ship, sent to Kure in Japan for the purposes of getting further training, and then joining a regiment in Korea. His timing was off because he arrived in Korea, in Japan rather, I think the day that the Imjin River battle started, or the day before. He was swept up and put on the first plane to Daegu, and then shipped up to the front line, where he became a platoon commander, given a platoon. He was in the bag within, I think, 36 hours. Within, literally, the timing, within 72 hours of setting foot on Japan, he was captured and in due course met me. He had a slight leg wound on his left leg, which I suspect was a flesh wound, but I don't know. He was a very funny lad because he was singularly uncommunicative about the state of his health and his leg. And it was just he and I, and a number, we were only two officers, so we obviously chatted together more. And he went to Shrewsbury, or Stowe, I can't remember which, I think it was Stowe, no. That's all. I suspect that he was an only son, or his had an elder brother who had been killed. That's pure supposition on my part, but he certainly was a very well protected by mum sort of man, boy. Because he slowly went downhill. His main problem was the fact that he was madly in love with an English girl who he used to take to Quaglino's, and he had every intention of marrying. I should point out that Beverly was certainly no more than 20 at the time. And the girl was slightly older than he was because she was about to have her 21st birthday. And he had written to his mother asking her to buy 21 long-stemmed red roses to give to this girl. The thing that was gnawing into Bevanet was the fact that he had competition. And the competition was from a Royal Navy pilot who was somewhere on HMS Theseus in the Yellow Sea. And in the very brief time that Beverly had been in Japan, he had heard that the Theseus was going home. And he had this image in his mind of this pilot stealing his girl. Anyhow, some couple of weeks later, I sold my watch to a passing Korean boy in exchange for jammed, filled chapatis. And I think I'm right in saying I bought 20 jammed, filled chapatis for them in exchange for my army issue watch. And the reason for 20 was that there were 20 of us present. The boy brought in two batches, he brought the 20 warm chapatis, and I issued them one to everybody present. And the second batch, last people got them, and I last for one I offered to Beverly Girl. And Beverly said, no, thank you, Jenny. And I said, why the hell not? They're not delectable. And I will never forget the use of the word delectable lying somewhere in North Korea, lice-ridden. it just didn't seem to make sense. The next day, because of course he wasn't eating anything, much as we tried to make him. The next day the Chinese came and took him away, and then about 2 days later came and told us that he died. And that was a total, utter, there's no reason in the world why that boy should have died, except he allowed this absurd situation of this girl to get to him. And he'd never been taught that he didn't have to die. I mean, he just had never... Anyhow. Then, from that point onwards, which would have been... I think he died on June the 6th or something. About then, yeah, beginning of June. From then until December, early December, I was moving from one village to another village to another village, and the people I were with changed from a few Gloucesters to a couple of Americans to another bunch of Gloucesters. And some were more interesting than others, but on the whole, a very pleasant bunch of people. And we also were housed at times with Chinese soldiers, wounded. And all of this was in Korean houses in the Korean villages. And it is because of that experience I came to my 10% rule, which regardless of culture, education, color, creed, whatever, 10% of the world are shits, and 10% are saints, and the rest of us are somewhere in the middle. And it's got nothing to do with nationality or being British. Or some of the Chinese soldiers were wonderful. There was one man, we had one night where it had been pouring with rain, and it was absolutely ghastly day. He appears, brought in, and he was a truck driver, Chinese truck driver, who had just been shot up that night before. And if anybody had a right to be a little miffed with us, he had. He arrived. At the time I was with two Americans, a sergeant and a private soldier. And he settles in this doorway to this Korean farm. And well, they blocked up the back, throwing straw on the floor, and that was our quarters. And after he'd settled in, a Korean boy passes, and he calls the boy over and gives him some money. And the boy comes back with a pack of cigarettes and some fruit. And the Chinaman opens up the pack of cigarettes, takes one, throws the pack to us. So we thank him profusely and take one cigarette to share between the three of us. And he, no. Take one each. And then we shared the fruit. After we'd run through about three packs of cigarettes, which he kept on replenishing, he did allow us to have one. We shared one between us while he had the other. He had one. But incredible generosity. Another case, it was a Korean mama-san who, during the day, was thoroughly unpleasant. She'd spit at us, always making sure she didn't hit us. But and she'd say, I don't know what she was saying, because she was speaking Korean, but she'd shout at us as we were living in a room off her gateway to the building. And she really was a witch. But we noticed at night somebody was leaving little niceties outside our door, like some soya sauce or some freshly cooked corn or little things like that. Koreans didn't have anything other than that. And so we arranged for somebody to stay awake all during the evening with an eye through a hole in the door to see who was putting the stuff there. And of course it was this woman, the mama-san of the farm, who felt that she couldn't be nice to us during the day because of the political implications. But went to great effort to be as nice as she possibly could at night without us ever knowing. Anyhow, in due course we were taken to Pyongyang in a truck, and we pulled in, and the truck went in to a bombed out shop and just hid underneath through the front of the shop where the glass had been blown out and the whole wall had been blown out. The truck just drove straight in there, so it couldn't be seen during the day by the American bombers. And a Korean doctor comes up to us and inquires after our health, anything he can do for us. And I said, aspirin would be very nice, if you could give us some aspirin. And he had to tell me that He couldn't give me aspirin. They didn't have aspirin. They could give us more. He could get us morphine. Couldn't get me any aspirin. They had no aspirin. And I, because I was brought up to believe that all drugs were dangerous, and I was very scared of becoming addicted to morphine, so I declined the offer of morphine. I just had, my gut told me that they might have a short-term benefit, but the long-term benefit wouldn't be worth it, so I declined it. And the problem was that most of us had a broken limb of some sort, or ribs or whatever. And so the bumping in a truck at night was a little uncomfortable. Anyhow, in due course, we go to the Bean Camp. The Bean Camp was a disused open cast mine. I say disused, it was a mine, it was disused. And the Chinese had some form of transit camp for prisoners in the bottom of the mine. The mine did have a very nasty reputation because it was a prison camp during the Second World War, and a lot of British and Allied forces had been kept in the Bean Camp by the Japanese and Koreans. Anyhow, the only reason I bring the Bean Camp up is that when we were there, they decided, for reasons I cannot remember, to celebrate the October Revolution or some such, and they gave us a banquet. Totally absurd. But welcome. And I can remember we were taken into this large room, in a wooden barrack room type building, where they'd arranged the tables, covered them with a white paper tablecloth, and sitting down the center of the table were bowls of sugar, which was absolutely, we hadn't had sugar since. I think I'm right in saying that the October Revolution is in fact celebrated in November, I think. Calendar problem. So we had not had sugar since April, and I was very happy to. And we had the inevitable soup and rice and chapatis. But as we were leaving, people were stealing the bowls of sugar, which was a perfectly reasonable thing to do under the circumstances. But I stole the spoon which went with the sugar bowl in front, which I still have today, and I'll show you. Beautiful Korean brass spoon, which I love dearly. And it is my good luck charm, and I've kept it with me from that day to this. It's a thing of beauty. Anyhow, beginning of December, for reasons unknown, I think it was the 8th, but I don't know, I arrive at Camp 2. Prior to that, I went to Camp 5, which is the other rank camp, up on the Yalu, very close to the Yalu. And then a week later, a truck takes me to the officer camp, Camp 2. And Well, you go through the normal signing in process. And I've been taken into the camp to a room, which was not in the main building, but it was behind the main building. And as I'm, by that time it was dark, and I'm, the guard indicates that I'm to go into this room, which I do, and it had, there wasn't an electric light, and the first person I see is Randall Cook, who I had known for years, and the 8th Zone, and who then took me under his wing. And the following day, after breakfast, breakfast being it wasn't rice, I can't remember, some grain. I can't, sorry, my mind's gone totally blank.
Sorghum? Sorghum.
Sorghum, thank you. And sorghum and daikon soup. could just as well have been hot water. After breakfast, he takes me into the main building, which was a wooden structure. It was an old Korean school, one-story school, had a corridor running from one end to the other on the north side of the building, and then the classrooms went from the corridor. Windows on the front of the building, which lit the classrooms, and all of which was raised off, was on a bank, so to speak, 5 foot above the playground, which was used as a parade ground in our case. And anyhow, Randall takes me and introduces me to all the Brits and a few Americans who he knew. And the Brits were all together in the main, in various classrooms. And we walk up and down, and I'm introduced, and many, many of them, of course, I knew. And with some I didn't. And in the last room of Brits, there were about three rooms, classrooms, I suppose, with Brits in it. I'm introduced to this young Navy guy, who says, "Ah, sir, you knew Beverly Gale, didn't you?" Well, there was only one naval pilot shot down and captured, and he was the boyfriend, the rival boyfriend of the girl, of Beverly Gale. And which only goes to show that you shouldn't take life too seriously. And that was a, if not, well, obviously Beverly Gale died because he didn't eat, but the reason, one of the reasons he didn't eat was because of his fixation about the girl and his competition. And the competition was locked up in prison in North Korea while all this was going on. Then life progressed from had a couple of sojourns, and once I went back to Camp 5 to because my leg was acting up, They didn't, in fact, do anything. Which I don't say in a negative sense, but there's nothing they could do. And then on another occasion, I went into solitary, but not as a punishment situation, simply as a medical thing. They couldn't decide what to do with me, so I was taken out of the camp. And well, the interesting thing there was that I met a young American Marine corporal who the Chinese had worked over and tried to get him to admit to germ warfare. And he described how they tried to get, how they worked on him, which was very simply stated. He was captured, and they took him off and housed him with three English-speaking Chinamen who were all extremely nice to him, and he ate very well, and they were all very, very pleasant. This went on for about a week. Then two of the Chinamen, the Chinese went on to shifts. So we each took an 8-hour shift. And then they started asking him questions and suggesting the answers. And when he didn't react, they started cutting back on the food. And then they eventually got down to cutting back on the sleep, to the point that he wasn't allowed to sleep. He'd suddenly go out and they'd wake him up again immediately, keep working on him. He was lucky they got bored before he did. And, he never did admit to anything, but he, as others, I was never in this personally in that situation, but other people who were worked on, every one of them admits that they would have given in at some point. The fact that they hadn't was such a matter, it was only a matter of time. When I was in Camp 5, in the hospital at Camp 5, I met a Canadian corporal who had been a guard on Koji Island, which was our prison camp. And I'm sorry to have to say that the Americans who managed that camp United Nations have no grounds to complain about the treatment meted out to Allied prisoners. Just unspeakable. I have to assume that this boy was telling me the truth, and there's no reason why he shouldn't, because it was just he and I in isolation. So.
What did he tell you?
Well, one of the things was, first of all, they had a fence around the prisoners. And no buildings, tents. Pours of rain, of course.